Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is November 11th, and before we start the show today, I want to say thanks to a couple people for their very thoughtful, very cool, and clever donations I received recently through the mail. The first one comes from a listener named Eric, who's out in Oregon. I get back to New Hampshire last week. I find there's a package waiting for me. I tear it open. There's nothing more exciting than a package, folks. Inside, I find an ounce of silver and a Clockwork Orange poster. You might remember that we did that show about Clockwork Orange way back when. Very thoughtful. And Eric also included a skiing DVD that he made out at a mountain in Oregon. So thank you, Eric, so much. I was so excited to have that waiting for me when I got back to NH. And the other donation actually came from a company. When I was down in Connecticut, Rich had a couple of really cool t-shirts. And I said, Rich, where did you get those shirts? And when he told me about the company, I realized that this was actually a person in our community named Daniel. So I sent him an email. The name of the t-shirt company is Third. And their website is wearethird.net. I said, can I get one of those shirts? Sure enough, couple days ago, it arrived. I opened it. It's beautiful. It says Mind the Control. And I'll put up a picture of me wearing it. It's a very, very nice shirt. So thanks to Daniel. The t-shirt company is Third, and the website is wearethird.net. Happy to do a little promotion in exchange for such a nice shirt. Now, I'll do this for anybody. Okay, like here's an example. Let's say you're on the board of directors of Canon, the camera company, and you're looking for some promotion. Well, you send me one of those 60Ds, boom, Canon.com goes right into the monologue of the podcast. Thousands of ears suddenly perk up to Canon.com. Maybe you work for Shure, the microphone company. You know, you're a product development engineer or something. I don't know. I'm not in the microphone business. Send me one of those SM7Bs, boom. That's how it will work. You know, we will scratch backs around here when backs are being scratched. So sincerely, though, thank you so much to Eric and thank you to Daniel from the Third T-shirt company. And I also want to thank Manuel, somebody who you don't know yet, but he's actually going to be doing this podcast with me on World War II. He's a longtime listener to School Sucks Podcast. I met him at Pork Fest, the Porcupine Freedom Festival in New Hampshire last year. Loved his energy. He was so passionate and he had, you know, so much to say about this topic of World War II. Almost immediately after meeting, we started talking about this show. We recorded it a month ago. I have been at the edge of my seat waiting to release it. I wanted to be done with the Trivium series and I realized, wow, that's going to line up nicely with what is referred to in many places, Remembrance Day or Veterans Day. That's today. And he apparently had such a good time that he sent me a nice donation afterwards. So thank you, Manuel. He does have a French accent. I had no problem understanding anything he said. It might take a couple minutes to get used to, but I'm really, really glad we had this opportunity to do this show together on this very, very important topic. So that will all be introduced appropriately once we get started here. This is School Sucks Podcast, episode 246, Down the Remembrance Hole, Myths of World War II. Damn good title. All right, gang, here's the show. Don't forget to vote for us in the 2013 Podcast Awards. There's a link right on the front page of our website, or you just go to podcastawards.com. We are in the education category. FTL, Free Talk Live, and Freedom Main Radio are in the politics category. And our friends Flaming Freedom, that's Dale's show, we used to use his studio to do our live show, is in the LGBT category. All right, here's the show.
Hitler didn't want a general war. What he wanted, and I have no doubt about this, he wanted a war to destroy Poland. That he was prepared for. For a moment, he was disconcerted to find that he might be involved in war with Britain and France, because this had never been his plan. He had always regarded Britain as his natural ally. But in the end, he accepted. Look, I have a Nazi-Soviet pact which guarantees that this will not develop into a general war. I should be able to knock Poland out in 3 weeks, which he more or less did. After that, the West isn't going to start up a war again.
France asked Hitler for an armistice. Shortly before 3 o'clock on the afternoon of June the 21st, 1940, he arrived in the forest of Compiègne. Hitler himself took the seat where Marshal Foch had sat. The French delegation, led by General Hunziker, followed closely behind. When the French delegation entered the carriage, Hitler could fully relish the peak of his career. Long ago, on entering politics, he had sworn never to rest until the shame of November 1918 had been wiped out. Now he had done it. But the dream of his lifetime, he said, had been fulfilled. Berlin greeted him with flowers and jubilation. Hitler's triumphal return to Berlin was in a flood of respect and adulation.
The church bells rang all day, and a mood of elation really penetrated throughout the country.
My feelings towards Hitler were such as if he were some superhuman being between man and a god sent by providence.
This was the man who had obliterated the humiliation of the First World War.
We started the show today with a clip from a documentary film called Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. Many who view this film, even part of this film, the whole documentary is over 6 hours long, would certainly argue that it tells the story of the life of Adolf Hitler from the time he was a young man through the Second World War, from a dangerously sympathetic point of view. There might be some validity to that argument, but if you're confident in your level of intellectual self-defense, you can certainly watch a documentary like The Greatest Story Never Told, and you'll know where the bias is, and you'll be able to deal with it appropriately. I found it to be not just a beautiful film visually. Some of the footage that's used is unlike anything I've ever seen before. But it also helped me realize, and I think would help a lot of open-minded people realize, that the evil and insanity that through our history seemed so concentrated in Nazi Germany during the 1930s and 1940s is actually spread a lot more uniformly through the superstates of the world at that time, including the United States and Great Britain, but obviously, the Soviet Union and Stalin. The clips that I selected for this show, it was two short clips, both come from the middle of the film. And at this point, we're talking 1939, 1940, Hitler believes he has righted this terrible wrong from the First World War, and according to the film anyway, sees himself as being involved in a somewhat minor and regional conflict. As you know, that situation did not continue for very long. So that being said, I wanted to start the show today by reading a speech. It was a speech given by Adolf Hitler, and it was his justification for declaring war on the United States in 1941. The entire speech is an hour and a half, and I'm only going to read a portion of it here. I'm guessing that this is roughly a half hour into it. The speech was delivered publicly December 11th, 1941. It's also worth mentioning that until recently, there was not a full English translation of this speech available. So we begin, like I said, roughly 30, 40 minutes into a 90-minute address. With regard to Germany's relationship with America, the following should be said. Number one, Germany is perhaps the only great power which has never had a colony in either North or South America. Nor has it been otherwise politically active there, apart from the emigration of many millions of Germans with their skills, from which the American continent, and particularly the United States, has only benefited. Number two, in the entire history of the development and existence of the United States, the German Reich has never been hostile or even politically unfriendly towards the United States. To the contrary, many Germans have given their lives to defend the USA. Number three, the German Reich has never participated in wars against the United States, except when the United States went to war against it in 1917. It did so for reasons that have been thoroughly explained by a commission, a special, this is just a footnote here, a special U.S. Senate Investigating Committee from 1934 to 1935, chaired by General Gerald Nye. Back to the speech, which President Roosevelt himself established. This commission to investigate the reasons for America's entry into the First World War clearly established that the United States entered the war in 1917 solely for the capitalist interests of a small group, and that Germany itself had no intention to come into conflict with America. Now, just to pause there for a second, some of you might be saying, define capitalist. Tell me where manipulating state power from behind the scenes fits into that definition. Certainly, understood. And it's also a good point to stop and just ask you to reference back to some of our earlier shows, specifically the third part of How the Truth Became Illegal with Richard Grove and Kevin Cole, but also the addendum to that series where I read Wall Street Banks and American Foreign Policy, written by Murray Rothbard. We continue. Furthermore, there are no territorial or political conflicts between the American and German nations that could possibly involve the existence or even the vital interests of the United States. The forms of government have always been different, but this cannot be a reason for hostility between different nations. As long as one form of government does not try to interfere with another outside of its naturally ordained sphere. America is a republic led by a president with wide-ranging powers of authority. Germany was once ruled by a monarchy with limited authority, but then by a democracy that lacked authority. Today, it is a republic of wide-ranging authority. Between these two countries is an ocean. If anything, the differences between capitalist America and Bolshevik Russia, if these terms have any meaning at all, must be more significant than those between an America led by a president and a Germany led by a Führer. It is a fact that the two historical conflicts between Germany and the United States were stimulated by two Americans, that is, by Presidents Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt, although each was inspired by the same forces. History itself has rendered its verdict on Wilson. His name will always be associated with the most base betrayal in history of a pledge. And that's a reference to Wilson's 14 points. The result was the ruin of national life, not only in the so-called vanquished countries, but among the victors as well. Because of this broken pledge, which alone made possible the imposed Treaty of Versailles, countries were torn apart, cultures were destroyed, and the economic life of all was ruined. Today we know that a group of self-serving financiers stood behind Wilson. They used this paralytic professor to lead America into a war from which they hoped to profit. The German nation once believed this man and had to pay for this trust with political and economic ruin. After such a bitter experience, why is there now another American president who is determined to incite wars and, above all, to stir up hostility against Germany to the point of war? National Socialism came to power in Germany in the same year that Roosevelt came to power in the United States. At this point, it is important to examine the factors behind the current developments. First of all, on the personal side of things, I understand very well that there is a world of difference between my own outlook on life and attitude and that of President Roosevelt. Roosevelt came from an extremely wealthy family. By birth and origin, he belonged to that class of people that is privileged in a democracy and assured of advancement. I myself was the only child of a small and poor family, allegedly. I'm adding the allegedly. and I had to struggle through life by work and effort in spite of immense hardships. As a member of the privileged class, Roosevelt experienced the First World War in a position under Wilson's shadow. FDR was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy under Wilson. As a result, he only knew the agreeable consequences of conflict between nations, from which some profited while others lost their lives. During the same period, I lived very differently. I was not one of those who made history or profits, but rather one of those who carried out orders. As an ordinary soldier during those 4 years, I tried to do my duty in the face of the enemy. Of course, I returned from the war just as poor as when I entered in the fall of 1914. I thus shared my fate with millions of others, while Mr. Roosevelt shared his with the so-called upper 10,000. After the war, while Mr. Roosevelt tested his skills in financial speculation in order to profit personally from the inflation, that is, from the misfortune of others, I still lay in a military hospital along with many hundreds of thousands of others. Experienced in business, financially secure, and enjoying the patronage of his class, Roosevelt then finally chose a career in politics. During the same period, I struggled as a nameless and unknown man for the rebirth of my nation, which was the victim of the greatest injustice in its entire history. Two different paths in life. Franklin Roosevelt took power in the United States as a candidate of a thoroughly capitalistic party, which helps those who serve it. When I became Chancellor of the German Reich, I was the leader of a popular national movement, which I had created myself. The powers that supported Mr. Roosevelt were the same powers I fought against, out of concern for the fate of my people and out of the deepest inner conviction. The brain trust that served the new American president was made up of members of the same national group that we fought against in Germany as a parasitical expression of humanity, and which we began to remove from public life. And yet, we also had something in common. Franklin Roosevelt took control of a country with an economy that had been ruined as the result of democratic influences, and I assumed the leadership of a Reich that was also on the edge of complete ruin, thanks to democracy. There were 13 million unemployed in the United States, while Germany had 7 million unemployed and another 7 million part-time workers. In both countries, public finances were in chaos, and it seemed that the spreading economic depression could not be stopped. From then on, things developed in the United States and in the German Reich in such a way that future generations will have no difficulty in making a definitive evaluation of the two different socio-political theories. Whereas the German Reich experienced an enormous improvement in social, economic, cultural, and artistic life in just a few years under National Socialist leadership, President Roosevelt was not able to bring about even limited improvements in his own country. This task should have been much easier in the United States, with barely 15 people per square kilometer, as compared to 140 in Germany. If economic prosperity is not possible in that country, it must be the result of either a lack of will by the ruling leadership or the complete incompetence of the men in charge. In just 5 years, the economic problems were solved in Germany, and unemployment was eliminated. During the same period, President Roosevelt enormously increased his country's national debt, devalued the dollar, further disrupted the economy, and maintained the same number of unemployed. But this is hardly remarkable when one realizes that the intellects appointed by this man, or more accurately, who appointed him, of the same group who, as Jews, are interested only in disruption and never in order. While we in the National Socialist Party took measures against financial speculation, it flourished tremendously under Roosevelt. The New Deal legislation of this man was spurious and consequently the greatest error ever experienced by anyone. If his economic policies had continued indefinitely during peacetime, there is no doubt that sooner or later they would have brought down this president, in spite of all his dialectical cleverness. Well, pots and kettles there, Mr. Hitler. In a European country, his career would certainly have ended in front of a national court for recklessly squandering the nation's wealth, and he would have hardly have avoided a prison sentence by a civil court for criminally incompetent business management. Many respected Americans also shared this view. A threatening opposition was growing all around this man, which led to him to think that he could only save himself by diverting public attention from his domestic policies to foreign affairs. In this regard, it is interesting to study the reports of Polish Ambassador Potocki from Washington, which repeatedly point out that Roosevelt was fully aware of the danger that his entire economic house of cards would collapse, and that therefore he absolutely had to divert attention to foreign policy. The circle of Jews around Roosevelt encouraged him in this. With Old Testament vindictiveness, they regarded the United States as the instrument that they could use to prepare a second Purim, I believe a Hebrew word for the slaughter of enemies, against the nations of Europe, which were increasingly anti-Jewish. So it was that the Jews, in all of their satanic baseness, gathered around this man, and he relied on them. The American president increasingly used his influence to create conflicts, intensify existing conflicts, and above all, to keep conflicts from being resolved peacefully. For years, this man looked for a dispute anywhere in the world, but preferably in Europe, that he could use to create political entanglements with American economic obligations to one of the contending sides, which would then steadily involve America in the conflict and thus divert attention from his own confused domestic economic policies. His actions against the German Reich in this regard have been particularly blunt. Starting in 1937, he began a series of speeches, including a particularly contemptible one on October 5, 1937, in Chicago, with which this man systematically incited the American public against Germany. He threatened to establish a kind of quarantine against the so-called authoritarian countries. As part of this steady and growing campaign of hate and incitement, President Roosevelt made another insulting statement, November 15, 1938, and then called the American ambassador in Berlin back to Washington for consultations. Starting in November 1938, he began systematically and consciously to sabotage every possibility of a European peace policy. In public, he hypocritically claimed to be interested in peace, while at the same time, he threatened every country that was ready to pursue a policy of peaceful understanding by blocking credits, economic reprisals, calling in loans, and so forth. In this regard, the reports of Polish ambassadors in Washington, London, Paris, and Brussels provide a shocking insight. This man increased his campaign of incitement in January 1939. In a message to the U.S. Congress, he threatened to take every measure short of war against the authoritarian countries. He repeatedly claimed that other countries were trying to interfere in American affairs, and he talked a lot about upholding the Monroe Doctrine. Starting in 1939, he began lecturing about internal European affairs that were of no concern of the President of the United States. In the first place, he doesn't understand these problems. And secondly, even if he did understand them and appreciated the historical circumstances, he has no more right to concern himself with Central European affairs than the German head of state had to take positions on or make judgments about conditions in the United States. Mr. Roosevelt went even beyond that. Contrary to the rules of international law, he refused to recognize governments he didn't like, would not accept new ones, refused to dismiss ambassadors of non-existent countries, and even recognized them as legal governments. He went so far as to conclude treaties with these ambassadors, which then gave him the right to simply occupy foreign territories. On April 15, 1939, Roosevelt made his famous appeal to me and the Duce, and the Duce, that's a reference to Mussolini. With a mixture of geographical and political ignorance combined with the arrogance of a member of the millionaire class, we were called upon to make declarations and to conclude non-aggression pacts with a number of countries, many of which were not even independent because they had either been annexed or turned into subordinate protectorates by countries allied with Mr. Roosevelt. That's a reference to the UK and France. You will recall, my deputies, that then I gave a polite but straightforward answer to this obtrusive gentleman, which succeeded in stopping, at least for a few months, the storm of chatter from this unsophisticated warmonger. But now the honorable wife took his place. She and her sons refused to live in a world such as ours. That is at least understandable, for ours is a world of work and not one of deceit and racketeering. After a short rest, though, he was back at it. On November 4th, 1939, the Neutrality Act was revised and the arms embargo was repealed in favor of a one-sided supply of weapons to Germany's adversaries. In the same way, he pushed in Eastern Asia for economic entanglements with China that would eventually lead to effective common interests. That same month, he recognized a small group of Polish emigrants as a so-called government in exile, the only political basis of which was a few million Polish gold pieces they had taken from Warsaw. On April 9th, this is 1940, he froze all Norwegian and Danish assets in the United States on the lying pretext of wanting to keep them from falling into German hands, even though he knew full well, for example, that Germany has not interfered with, much less taken control of, the Danish government's administration of its financial affairs. Along with the other governments in exile, Roosevelt now recognized one for Norway. On May 15, 1940, Dutch and Belgian governments in exile were also recognized, and at the same time, Dutch and Belgian assets were frozen. This man revealed his true attitude in a telegram of June 15th to French Premier Renault. Roosevelt told him that the American government would double its aid to France on the condition that France continue the war against Germany. In order to give special emphasis to his desire that the war continue, he declared that the American government would not recognize acquisitions brought about by conquest, which included, for example, the retaking of territories that had been stolen from Germany. I do not need to emphasize that now and in the future, the German government will not be concerned about whether or not the President of the United States recognizes a border in Europe. I mention this case because it is characteristic of the systematic incitement of this man, who hypocritically talks about peace while at the same time he incites to war.
Now I'm going to pause there. Hitler certainly continues. He goes on to discuss in detail what he views as Roosevelt's violations of international maritime law, which are quite extensive, and I will make sure that the entire text of the speech is linked in the show notes for today's episode. If you're anything like me, you probably found yourself at some points almost ricocheting between agreement and disagreement. This is a version of the story that we've told on the show before. And while we may disagree with Adolf Hitler about the virtues of National Socialism and also with his use of the term Jews to describe a far more vast and complex network of international bankers, corporations, politicians, intellectuals, and internationalists, there's a lot of truth there. But I have to admit that I haven't spent much time listening to what Hitler had to say about anything regarding World War II or the lead up to World War II. Now, maybe you're in the same boat. And I think there's a lot of people who've never even considered the possibility that Hitler might have had something important or educational to say about this whole period in history, or that evidenced a deeper understanding of internationalist motivations or the motivations of the people calling themselves government in the United States and Great Britain. And this is why it's a continuous process of going back. Right? Because this is an avenue of history. Now, spoiler alert, we don't find out that Hitler is actually the protagonist. Let's be super clear about that. But from this propaganda, this poison, the U.S. nationalism that I had ingested at a very early age, all of these avenues of historical exploration were just closed off to me. So understanding the evil nature of Hitler and Nazism means that there's, and even though, you know, I want to be careful about how we use the word evil, and I really want to try and get away from using it altogether because it's a word that closes things off. I was asking somebody to explain to me some political issue the other night, and they were like, well, you know, here's the thing. My side, I mean, it boiled down to this. My side is like smart and forward-looking and virtuous, and the other side is evil and resentful and dumb. And I said, gosh, wow, you're lucky that it always plays out that way for you. That way, you really never have to think about anything. And I feel like we're doing that a lot with history and we're not even realizing it. You know, just because the verdict, the historical verdict on Hitler is in, doesn't mean that there aren't nuances of this story that are worth re-examining. Because there's learning opportunities there. Did I already mention that you're not going to find out that Hitler is actually a good guy? Very, very important that I make that clear. Now, today is Veterans Day, and I considered not releasing the show today because I didn't want it to be perceived by anyone as disrespectful to the millions of people who have had to endure tremendous hardships as the result of imperialism and propaganda and war profiteering. Those people want to believe their loved ones died for something, that they suffered for something, that they were injured or stricken with some terrible condition like PTSD as the result of all that. But the point of reading a speech like that for almost a half an hour is to understand that wars don't have protagonists. They do obviously have countless victims. You can't get people to go to war if they don't believe they are the protagonists. I thought Hitler's comparison, where he compares himself to Roosevelt, now obviously he's presenting himself as the hero of this story. So obviously it should be taken with a grain of salt, but the comparison is still interesting. Right? While Roosevelt moved on to profit from American imperialism financially and politically, you know, I was in a hospital. Now, Hitler, by the time he's giving this speech in 1941, he's got a nice story. He got up, he got out of the hospital, he rose to power. He, at that point, feels like he's righted some of the wrongs of World War I and the Versailles Treaty. But there are so many others who shared his conviction in the First World War who didn't have such a lovely kind of rags-to-riches story after that war. In the 1920s and the 1930s. And even when we look, I mean, these are suffering people. We look at the leadership of the Nazi Party, the hypervigilance, the paranoia, the bloodlust, the desire for revenge. That was born out of the First World War. Now, as far as this speech is concerned, from December of 1941, portions of this were published in the New York Times, but they were very, very selective. And they obviously didn't provide Americans with the bigger picture that Hitler was discussing. I did find one example of a radio broadcast from that date, December 11, 1941, where a translator is doing his best to share with the audience what Hitler is saying. I'll play a clip.
Es war der Jude in seiner ganzen satanischen Niedertracht, der sich um diesen Mann scharte, nachdem dieser Mann aber auch griff.
I can well understand, the Führer said, that there is a worldwide gulf between the outlook of President Roosevelt and that of myself. Roosevelt, of course, comes from a wealthy family and has had all the advantages of an upbringing in that circle. I, of course, became a soldier and simply took orders. In fact, I shared my fate with millions, and Roosevelt shared his fate with the upper class of a couple of 10,000. During the inflation, Roosevelt went on earning money, whereas the Führer, as he said, remained in hospital. And we know that President Roosevelt himself was fully aware of the difficulties of an internal nature which were increasing in his own country.
But most Americans in the lead up to World War II, in fact, almost all Americans in the lead up to World War II, were provided with a far less nuanced understanding of the situation.
In an all-out determination to avenge the hideous assault on American lives and property. Our battle cry is, remember Pearl Harbor. The president's signature speeds our total defense energies and resources to all-out victory. The evil mastermind of aggression is forced into the open. The world's number one arsonist and killer declares the war on the United States, and his stooges applaud. The vociferous junior partner in crime follows suit. Now practically the entire world is joined in a horrible war. The president bought the first defense bond and set an early example for us all. Let's get behind our army, our navy, and our president.
Fellow Americans, I ask you to demonstrate again your faith in America by joining me in investing in the new defense savings bonds and stamps. And I know that you will help.
I'm very pleased to welcome Manuel Pasquale, who is, first of all, I should say, a longtime listener of the School Sucks podcast, as well as some other familiar shows. He is nearing completion in his study of history at the university level. And, you know, maybe some of the things that he's heard from these types of sources of media, taking that to a university level history study, might ruffle a few feathers, but he is compiling some interesting research, some relatively controversial research, considering what mainstream thought is in the Western world, on the very, very large subject of World War II. So first of all, Manuel, I want to welcome you. Thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing this with us.
Thank you very much, Brett, for inviting me. I'm really happy to do this with you today. And that was a great to meet you in person at the Pork Fest last summer. Thank you.
Yeah, that was fun. It was brief and it was rainy, but yeah, and I look forward to doing that in the future. You are in Canada, so that's not too far away. So
yeah, but worry. I can do a little disclaimer. My first language is French, so I may have a French accent. Mm-hmm. And it may happen that in English there is a word I'm not sure of it, that I may try to find it in my head. So for your listeners that are in the U.S., just to know that I'm in the French part of Canada called Quebec. So, yeah.
This is good because before we get into the really heavy stuff, you can talk a little bit about yourself because you have a very interesting story. Where you came from as far as ideas are concerned is very interesting. And as we talk through this, my listeners can get a feel for that accent if they're unfamiliar. And by the time we start dropping knowledge, they'll be used to it. So can you tell us a little bit about where you came from, how you came to these ideas and where you were before that?
But as I told you, 5 years ago, I used to be a hardcore Marxist. And I was kind of curious because I wanted to listen to some podcasts and there was not a lot of thing on Marxism. So I decided, hey, I want to listen to some things that, you know, talk about the subject of socialism and capitalism, even if it's not in a favorite way. So first I listened to conservative stuff. That was totally, I think, crazy. But then I found the libertarian and, hey, wait a minute. They're anti-war like I was. Oh my God, it's so strange. Hey, they're not anti-gay. They're not for the war on drug. They're not so much religious, hey, but they're for free speech. Oh my! Now I was kind of what is that? So I was curious, and one day I remember I was looking for a lot of podcasts, and one day I listened to I could use podcasts like I was consuming them in a very, very fast way, mm-hmm. And one day I find a podcast, and it was written from Stéphane Molyneux, number 207. I say, oh my God, number 207. That means there's probably 206 podcasts before that. And then Free Domain Radio, it was a huge treasure. And it started like Podcast Zero, Introduction to Libertarianism. Stéphane was talking about like every subject. And I started to listen to that. And I would say that day by day, my Marxism, edifice, if I can say that.
Yeah,
my
yeah.
Marxism building was kind of falling apart a little bit. And then I start talking with people of Free Domain Radio. I went to a barbecue of Stéphane Molyneux. But it still took me, I would say, at least two years. I can even remember the day exactly that I really accepted the non-aggression principle as as a fundamental principle. But even at that time, I still thought that socialism was the solution. I just thought that it needed to be applied voluntarily.
Mm-hmm.
But after maybe a year after that, I understand that I think the free market is more efficient, even if I think that some aspect of, you know, taking care of the poor and to have solidarity amongst people, it must be done in a free society. So that's kind of my background. I was mostly interested in wars when I was a Marxist. For me, was probably what interested me the most. So by listening to Stefan Molyneux and then to your podcast, also to Lou Rockwell about that, I find some great things against the war. But what is most funny is that even as when I was a Marxist at the end, I understood that World War II was an imperialist war, but I still thought it was a necessary war because I think we didn't have the choice. And it's Stefan Molyneux, the first who tell the idea that no, we shouldn't have intervened because it just made the thing worse. That's kind of it.
Yeah. I think, well, first of all, I applaud anybody who has a very firm ideology in place and goes out to seek contrasting and contradicting information like you did. How long would you say, in maybe a number of years, you spent as a Marxist prior to discovering Free Domain Radio and these other shows?
My interest in politics, I would say, started after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like everybody, we can remember what we were doing that day. It was really an event that kind of traumatized us. I remember receiving a call from my mother crying, "Look at that at the TV. It's awful." And yes. And then after that, I kind of saw articles that criticized a little bit the US and say, and I became curious. I said, yeah, why did such a thing happen? There must be something behind that. So, yeah, so I became, I would say, a leftist because, yeah, it was mostly, I would say, the left, the socialists that were criticizing U.S. imperialism for their intervention in the Middle East.
Yeah, you know, I just want to interject. I had a very, very similar experience at the same time. Now, in 2001, I had already studied history to some extent and had even done some student teaching, I think by that point, in a history class in a public school, but had really fallen in love with the subject. And when September 11th happened, I said, how could I have devoted so much time to trying to understand the history of the world? And I know nothing about why this would happen, why these people would hate us for our, you know, blessed freedom and, you know, how that part of the world or how that religion or that ideology works at all. And it was really a wake up call, to me. It certainly, you know, tragic of an event as it was, it certainly provided an opportunity for people to start asking questions. So I second that. I had a very similar experience.
Yeah. I remember at that time I learned that, I think it was from a socialist guy, I think his name is Jean Ziegler, a guy working for the UN, and he was saying that every day in the world there's kind of 100,000 people that dies from starvation and the effect of war in the third world. So 100,000 people every day. Okay. We almost don't talk about that. So, but we only talk about the 3,000 people that died on 9/11. And I don't want to reduce. It's tragic for those 3,000 people that didn't deserve to die. It was a horrible, violent act. But with that in mind today, what kind of world are we living in? What kind of hypocrisy the media are telling us? So yeah, I started to be interested, but you know, I went to, so in 2003, there were demonstrations against the war in Iraq. And I remember I went there. I received some, you know, some leaflets, some tracts. But it was mostly leftist people. Sadly, there were no libertarian or anarchists that were there to say, hey, we're not, you know, socialism is not the only voice against war. So yeah, that it wasn't those even that I grew up, and I read things on the internet, but yeah, I became a strong leftist Marxist.
Yeah, I didn't go as far as Marxism, but obviously because the foreign policy at least appeared, you know, a lot of things 2001 to 2003 appeared a certain way. And the questions that I initially started asking in 2001 led me on an interesting path that revealed a lot of things. But yeah, you know, it's interesting, too, this strange and certainly arbitrary ranking system for the value of human life based on where people live. It relates to our subject today in that, you know, that's really a product of patriotism and nationalism and flags and pledges of allegiance and national anthems, which I've described. I know it's a little hostile language, but those are kind of like the children's toys of how the world really works. When we start looking at, you know, maybe some of the deeper influences and deeper ideological roots that, you know, these events grow out of. And the people who never really come out of the shadows, or the types of people or the types of institutions that have this continuity of power and influence throughout the 20th century, if not beyond, looking at the history of the 20th century through that nationalist lens, really, really distorts the picture. And what we're going to do today is look at World War II from what I would call a certain angle. And I want to just differentiate looking at something from a certain angle from interpretations. Because when I used to teach history and I was real into Howard Zinn and very oriented towards the left, and this goes back to me kind of moving to the left when I saw that, you know, the Bush administration appeared from 2001 to 2003 to be running American foreign policy. Yes, I was very much a leftist. I was into Noam Chomsky. I was into Howard Zinn. And I was bringing this into the classroom where I taught. So obviously the People's History of the United States, and wait till you kids hear about who Columbus really was. And the, you know, the conservative people who ran the school would catch, you know, some of these, dialogues coming out of my classroom, and I would be spoken to about these things, and they would say, well, you know, what you're saying about Columbus is one interpretation. And obviously there are different ways to, interpret historical events, from the very close to what actually happened to, the kind of mythological. And we see a lot of both. We see a lot of the mythological when it comes to World War II, but we're looking at an angle here. So I would picture like a movie scene called World War II that's getting ready to be shot. And you have all these cameras positioned in different places where you can see, or you can focus in from a much larger picture. So from what we're going to cover today, I would say we're looking more at the political and statecraft angle. And hopefully we'll also be able to provide, as you said, an alternative strategy for a more libertarian type of government, what could have been done in 1940. So I'm very excited to get into this discussion. First of all, though, where did your research on this topic begin?
Maybe because I've always been a little bit of a marginal person. So when I saw that everybody believed in something, I was curious that maybe there's something wrong. I remember when I was a kid, there's a movie that came out, the movie Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a scene in the movie that was pretty violent. You saw it was in India, maybe in the 1920s or 30s. You saw a bunch of women and children gathering in a place, and then the British soldier came and they killed them all. And it's a very troubling scene to look at. And at that time, I had already had my first, you know, some history course, or maybe movies on World War II. And they said that the course said about World War II, it was the noble good war, the good allies, the US, the British, and the Russian, of course, against the evil German and Japanese. So, hey, wait, already in my mind, I thought the British were the good. They were the good against the evil Nazis. Oh, why are they shooting women and children in India? They should be the good people. So this, I have this scene in my mind, but of course, for a long time, I was all in the propaganda, still thinking that the Allies were good. And by being a Marxist, there was a criticism of, you know, the colonialism of the, of the European power.
Yep.
But as I said, even at the end, when I was a Marxist, I still thought that World War II was necessary, you know, because the Holocaust, that the Nazi wanted to rule the world, which I think is a total myth. Not the Holocaust. I'm not a Holocaust denier. I just want to be clear on that. But the idea that that Hitler wanted to rule the world, I think it's a myth that is made just to scare the people. As I will show, I think it's to rule the world is totally impossible.
And I will say this, obviously, there's a tremendous amount of evidence towards the persecution of Jews in Nazi Germany. That is undeniable as far as I'm concerned. I think it's also, though, even though it is controversial and even though it might upset a few people, to understand the Holocaust as an event that has continued to influence American foreign policy, or it's been this thing that you go back and you pull out of history's never again. And this has been used as a real emotional manipulator for influencing how the United States has and Great Britain has acted in the Middle East, ostensibly in support of Israel since the end of World War II.
Yeah. You previously said that we're going to watch World War II as a, you know, as a camera from a certain angle. And that made me thought that what I realized about World War II in my progression of learning is that the official dogma of the state is a very selective picking of the facts. Yeah, of course Hitler was evil, and I have to do this disclaimer. I'm really not a fan of Nazi Germany. It was a brutal regime. Mm-hmm. And yes, the murder, the exterminated Jews, but the whole thing as itself was what I call the myth about World War II. It's a very, very selective picking of historical facts that are true, but at the same time, by ignoring other facts that are also true, that doesn't fit with the conclusion that it was a good war necessary and everything like that. So that I would say that's my intention, that for why I'm studying and working on this issue. So.
Yeah, as I've said before, you know, wars have no protagonists. And yeah, that's certainly how this has been presented. And if people don't think about it carefully, you know, if you start saying, well, you know, the British in the United States had a very significant role to play in the escalation of this conflict as well. It wasn't entirely responsive to Nazi Germany. People, because it's an emotional topic, because, you know, you said there's been a tremendous amount of propaganda invested into World War II. And, you know, one of the results, unfortunately, of propaganda is framing evaluations in a very emotional and often, you know, what goes with emotional is illogical way of thinking about it. So people become very defensive about this because, as you said, it is very dogmatic. And as far as the angle thing is concerned, I did a series called the American Way Expanded, which was about 5 hours, that looked at some of the cultural, philosophical, and social factors that led to the rise of Adolf Hitler. So one lens or one angle which this scene can be shot is how trying to answer the question, how did the people let this happen? But our angle, maybe from a camera, you know, positioned a little bit higher today, is looking at the state angle, the more of the political top-down angle of this.
Yes.
And so that brings us to controversial claim number one: the Allies are greatly responsible for the rise of Nazi Germany, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And if I can do a metaphor, that I think Stéphane Molyneux made that metaphor very well, but when there were the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, it was like, you know, imagine I'm a security company and you hire me to protect yourself, but you realize that in fact I'm paying, you know, thugs and bandits to aggress and steal from you. Would you hire me a second time to protect you again? I think no.
Yeah.
9/11, you know, the Osama bin Laden things that he was paid by the CIA, and yeah, it happens, that's sad, but the idea of giving more power to the U.S. government is kind of absurd. And for World War II, we will see it's kind of a similar way. And now what we need to do a little background on World War I, because we cannot talk about World War II without talking of World War I. So. Mm-hmm. I think we both agree, and most people will a lot more easily agree that World War I was obviously a terrible imperialist war. It was not a good war. It was a conflict of imperial interest for a struggle for market and for colony. I think Lenin had a great quote, and I come from that background, and I know Lenin is an evil person for many evil things he did, but he had a great quote about World War I. He was saying, World War I is like two slave merchants waging war at each other for a new redistribution of the slave amongst them. And I really like that quote, because yeah, it shows that it's really two group of evil people struggling to know who will rule the world. So we know how it ended. World War I ended with the victory of the Allies, and then they imposed the Versailles Treaty on Germany, and I think you agree with me that the Versailles Treaty was totally unfair and harsh on the German people, because the Versailles Treaty was saying that the German people are all responsible for the First World War.
Yeah, it's the same thing, just to tie it back to the present day. It's the same thing that we're told the people calling themselves Al-Qaeda believe about the United States, that the people are responsible for the actions of the other people calling themselves government. Therefore, they all need to be punished. Now, obviously, when you're talking about terrorism, the punishments are more than just financial. But right up front, we have something like the War Guilt Clause, which is just obviously terrible for the morale and the identity. So this takes us back to that lower angle again of, you know, social and ideological factors. The German identity, the zeitgeist of that time, very demoralizing.
Yeah, of course, Germany was responsible, but I would say the responsible of that war were all the state who participated in that war. Mm-hmm. It was the war was caused by, I would say, statism, the central bank, and as you said very well, the public education system which encouraged people to become obedient, patriotic, and nationalistic. And what was the name of the philosopher that in Prussia? You know, started the public school system. Is it Fichte?
I've heard it pronounced Fichte, which is acceptable, but our German friend and listener to the podcast, Heiko, said it was Fichte. It was Fichte.
So I remember you saying that the objective of the public education system was to make, you know, children becoming good citizen and good soldier, obedient, good working, patriotic. So no surprise that such a war can happen when all countries that participate in the war all have the same system, all have a central bank. So the guilt of that war, I think it's there. It's not only the German people. So to impose some harsh reparation on the German people, making them a lot more poor, miserable, Also, the Versailles Treaty really splitted the German people. Some German people now were forced to live under Czechoslovakia, Poland, a little bit elsewhere. So it created a lot of anger and desire for revenge among the German people. So that's why that was easy for Hitler to came in and into the, all that frustration.
Yeah, as they rise to power in a very tumultuous political condition in Germany through the 20s, you know, they're also perpetuating this basically this stab in the back conspiracy theory. The world is out to get us, you know, starts there. I mean, Hitler starts telling this story when he's in jail for the beer hall putsch.
Yeah.
But there is, as we've covered here, a real basis for, I don't want to say that paranoia, but obviously that feeling of victimization.
Yeah, I think that, but I think you know about the thesis and the book of Jim Powell called Wilson's War,
mm-hmm.
How through
mm-hmm.
Wilson's great blunder led to Hitler, Lenin, Stalin, and World War II. The idea is that the intervention of the United States, which was absolutely not threatened by anyone, the intervention of the United States into the First World War was a terrible thing. The conclusion, I think, of Jim Powell, or I even heard Stefan Molyneux saying the same thing, is that if the U.S. would not have intervened, it would probably have ended as a stalemate, and no one could have been able to force what we call a harsh peace on the other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Without the U.S. intervening, probably the Versailles Treaty could not have been imposed to Germany. Like, the guilt would have gone to everybody. There would have been no reparation. So probably not all this shit would not have happened in Germany. I mean, with Hitler. But what is funny, and I think you know about that, is that when the U.S. came into the war, that the German government realized that it would have been impossible to win the war against, you know, Russia, Great Britain, France, and then the United States. So they try, as we say in English, I think, a last-ditch effort, sending Lenin, that was in Switzerland, by sending Lenin into Russia, giving him money and weapon, and hoping that he would do a revolution that would destabilize Russia. And, you know, the program of Lenin was to stop the war and to give back the land to the peasant at first. So, and I cannot disagree with that. I think, of course, the rest of his program was totally evil and destructive. But what is sad is that at that time, even the new government in Russia, after the first revolution in Russia, the temporary government, they wanted to continue the war, and Woodrow Wilson was giving money to that new government in Russia so that it could continue the war, while the people in Russia were totally exhausted and they were on the verge to revolt. And then the German government, hey, let's send Vladimir Lenin into that. So we know that the rest of history for what happened after that. So the idea that all that evil comes out of nowhere and that we have to support our government to fight it, I think it's totally absurd. We can see that our government are totally responsible for doing all those things.
Mm-hmm. And I think this kind of segues nicely to the next controversial point. In the book about Wilson, U.S. entry into World War I is referred to as a great blunder. Now, Wilson, from, you know, my assessment and my research, is a blunderer. He was a naive academic who, you know, I would even suggest that he probably believed that he was doing the right things. And from what I've gathered about his relationship with his chief advisor, one of these people in the first layer of shadows, Colonel Edward Mendel House, that Wilson actually felt betrayed by House's behavior and House's concessions during the proceedings in Versailles. Now, there's deeper shadows. Like, you could say, well, how serendipitous, if we wanted to be naive, I think we could say how serendipitous for all of the people in the United States and Great Britain who profit from a long, drawn-out world war, that 1 year prior to the beginning of World War I, the United States establishes a central bank that allows them to, you know, borrow the money necessary to almost, since 1913, almost continue in a perpetual state of war right up to the present day with very, very little respite. But I think that, you know, that leads us into this next claim here, that the Allies helped Nazi Germany with money, weapons, oil, technology, industry. And obviously, we're going back a little bit before the start of World War II.
I think you know about I think it's General Smedley Butler who wrote a book called War as a Racket, and he exposed all during World War I, people, you know, selling weapons, and not only weapons, I think horse saddle to the U.S. government, made a fortune.
Sure, yeah, horse saddles to an army with no cavalry.
Exactly. So they would, once you have a state and there's a war, even if the country is not threatened, those who are selling weapons have an incentive to participate in the war, no matter if they win, no matter who is going to win, they're just going to make money. So yes, the Allies really helped Nazi Germany to arm. There's an interesting book on that issue where all the facts are in. Like, I can say, like, Anthony Sutton wrote a book called Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. And in that book, he shows that, many rich people from Wall Street, and already we cannot talk about people that became rich only from the free market. It's many people who use the state at their advantage. I just think about the Young Plan. The Young Plan was a plan made, I think, by the U.S. government in the 1920s to help Germany with its economy, because Germany was unable to pay for the reparation to France and Great Britain. And if Germany doesn't pay its reparation to France and Great Britain, France and Great Britain cannot pay their debt to the U.S. So the Young Plan was to help Germany to start back its economy, but it still helped it to have some more war industry. So Young was he was the chairman of the Fed, and at another time he was the chairman of General Electric, who, you know, really sold weapon and technology to Nazi Germany. All the U.S. corporation that made money selling stuff to Nazi Germany is tremendous. You think about Ford, GM, Imperial Oil, IBM, ITT. Many of them continues to sell weapon once the U.S. was at war with Germany. I think General Motors and Ford, after the war, they asked for money to the U.S. government, because the U.S. government bombed their factory that they had in Germany. So they asked reparation to the U.S. government for their factory that were destroyed in Germany. I think it's absolutely absurd and ridiculous to claim that those company wanted to help the, you know, because after the war they tried to show themselves as, oh, we helped the war effort. Yeah, but they helped the war effort in both countries.
Yeah, and if we can just, I actually have a PDF copy of Sutton's book right here. So if we can just zoom in for a minute and give people a better look at the specifics of the Young Plan, I can share a paragraph that shows maybe some of the motivations that are in play here. The Young Plan was assertedly a device to occupy Germany with American capital and pledge German real assets for a gigantic mortgage held in the United States. Isn't that always the way? It is noteworthy that German firms with U.S. affiliations evaded the plan by device of temporary foreign ownership. For instance, AEG, German General Electric, that's AEG is the German abbreviation in German words for the German General Electric, affiliated with General Electric in the U.S., was sold to a Franco-Belgian holding company and invaded conditions of the Young Plan. It should be noted that in passing that Owen Young was a major financial backer for Franklin D. Roosevelt in the United European Venture when FDR, as a budding Wall Street financier, endeavored to take advantage of Germany's 1925 hyperinflation. The United European Venture was a vehicle to speculate and to profit upon the imposition of the Dawes Plan, which was, I believe, just a couple years, about 4 years prior to the implementation of the Young Plan, and is clear evidence of private financiers, including Franklin Delano Roosevelt, using the power of the state to advance their own interests by manipulating foreign policy.
Yes, it's not only the, because I talk about the US, Great Britain and France also helped Nazi Germany at that time, but even the Soviet Union helped a little bit Nazi Germany by sending them, you know, raw material. And what is funny is that the day that Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union, I think it was June 22nd, 1941, the moment that the German army was invading into the Soviet territory, there were still trains full of iron ore, oil, wheat that were going to Nazi Germany from the Soviet Union. So isn't it paradoxical that when you're supposed to protect your people from a bad guy, that in fact you're just giving money, raw material, weapon, technology?
You know, once you understand how much profiteering and how much behind the scenes influence is involved in a lot of what shows up in mainstream history, you can think of it as peeling an onion. You can think about it as walking deeper into the shadows. There's actually a really good book. It's available on Lou Rockwell in its entirety under the title Wall Street Wars, but it was written by Murray Rothbard, I believe, in the early 80s, and it's called Wall Street Banks and American Foreign Policy. And it traces this story, not in, you know, obviously it's not complete, but it's certainly a very, very thorough introduction to this topic.
Yeah.
Traces this history from the end of the 1800s right up through Vietnam, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think Anthony Sutton refers itself to Murray Rothbard, too, so...
Okay.
And there was I read great article because Murray Rothbard is probably one of the first, there's maybe other, I don't know, one of the first person to come openly as a revisionist on World War II. Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, it was a really important read for me. I actually read it into the record on the podcast because we had done a show prior, and I won't go into detail. People can go back and reference it. I think it's like episode 230, 231 on the Rhodes Roundtable groups, which was basically a template for, you know, how power and influence can be exerted towards some kind of consolidation of power on a global scale. This is where we get the phrase New World Order, which is easily derided by, conspiracy skeptics, actually comes out of this line of study. And, Rothbard talks about the influence of the Round Table and how that set up these think tanks like the British version of the CFR, what was it called? The Royal Institute of International Affairs and the Council on Foreign Relations. And their influence, not just over the media and public thought, but over policy itself. So I think that's one step deeper into the shadows. And I just wanted to enter that into the record. And it is something that we've covered to some extent on the show before.
Yes. Yeah. So
I can read what I have here. The Allies committed huge immoral crimes against mankind, including obviously imperialism and colonialism.
At first, when we want to talk about any subject like this, we have to define morality. So as libertarian, I think what is good and evil, fundamentally, I think to initiate the use of force, the use of violence against someone else, is it's evil, and morality is something that is universal. So if it's bad for Hitler to invade countries, to murder Jews, it cannot be good for Winston Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt to do the equivalent. The first aggression of this war is against the German or the American citizen that is forced to pay taxation, to get inflation from the central bank, and worst of all, to be conscripted. Because I think conscription is a terrible, evil aggression. So the evil starts there. Once Germany invaded Poland, you know, the aggression, as I said, came first as the German government forced people to pay tax, to go to public school, and to be drafted into the army. So yes, now if evil and morality is universal, so as we know, the Allies were greatly some colonial power. Great Britain was probably the greatest colonial empire. And I may agree that the colonialism of Great Britain may be a little bit less violent than the Nazi occupation of Poland, but it's still like comparing two rape, you know?
Yeah,
rape and a hard rape. I agree. You know, the intensity of the violence from British colonialism was probably less than Nazi Germany, but it's not an argument, because I heard conservative people saying, yeah, but it's they were not as much violent. You know, they brought technology to India. Yeah, but it's for me, it's not an argument. I can admit that it's true, but you cannot compare, as I said, a soft rape and a hard rape, and saying, ah, the soft rape is a good guy. No, it's still very evil to rape. So,
And this brings in that brings us back to the distortions that are created by nationalism, by patriotism, where suddenly, if we want to use the term morality, it's not universalizable anymore, because now, you know, it's one national identity versus another. So that the universalization of these principles, that doesn't matter. That can't even be talked about. It's upsetting to even ask questions about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, so Great Britain, you know, so that they exploited, they tortured, they killed. I think in India, I think, you know, they bombed village in India in the 1920s or 30s, you know. It's funny because we always see the bombers of the German bombers bombing British cities, when in fact, as I will show, it's Great Britain who bombed first German city and not the opposite. But the Royal Air Force was kind of, they already had some practice, because they bombed village in India in Africa. So I mean, you know, can you imagine a village in India? Yeah, they're not industrialized. They probably just want to get free. Mm-hmm. And you send some bombers over them, and then you claim to be morally good. So I think that's, you know, I wouldn't say that's funny, because it's tragic, but it's absurd to claim that you're a good guy after doing that.
It is, yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think too that there's some grammar there that should be just defined a little bit better when it comes to the Allies, because there's a lot of smaller pieces of that. You know, the Allies is this collection of the good guys in World War II, as far as the mainstream presentation is concerned. It includes, obviously, the United States, Great Britain, France, and ultimately the Soviet Union. Every single one of those allies is a state. The state is a combination of political power, special interests, profiteers from these kind of events, central banks, and also, you know, the undercurrent of ideology, education, and religion, and which ultimately translates too often in history to a blind support of the political and behind the scenes power.
Yeah, absolutely. So Great Britain, I think I said it, they probably murder, torture, exploited people all over in India, Africa, the Middle East. France, they did it in Northeast Africa. They did that into Indochina. Little Belgium, that looked like a little innocent country. I think in the Belgian Congo, it estimated, I think, for a generation that they murdered, they exterminated between 3 to 9 million Congolese people under their colonialism of King Leopold something. So, oh my God, that those people know that the Belgian exterminated like an equivalent amount of the Holocaust for the Congo. Most people don't know that. Mm-hmm. It's terrible. So, yeah, and the Netherlands, they had a colony into Indonesia where they that did some evil things. And even at that time, the U.S., the U.S. had conquered the Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico. I think in the 1920s or 30s, the people of the Philippines wanted to be free. So the U.S. massacred, I think, 100,000 people there that just wanted to be free. So, and yeah, and as you said, in the good, the Soviet Union was there. And I think we don't need to explain to the listener how evil was the Soviet Union. I personally, if you would give me the choice, you know, you have to live somewhere at that time. Yeah, I would have preferred to live in North America. No doubt about it. But I think I would have preferred to live in Nazi Germany rather than the Soviet Union. Because in the Soviet Union, you couldn't even own property. I mean, at least in the Nazi Germany, you could own, a small store. You can own a car. You can own a house. I would not have liked to live there. It was a awful place. But if it's a bad regime, we have to show that the Soviet regime of Stalin, with all the murder, the torture, the millions of people, its stars, it cannot fit into the good guys.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
About the Holocaust, as we said, there's no doubt that the Holocaust happened and Germany is responsible of it. But I think that the Allies have a responsibility in the Holocaust. And I mean, the Jewish extermination start around 1942, mm-hmm. as war became global. From when Hitler took power, immediately the Jews started to be persecuted. But it was not. I want to say that it's a good thing. No, it's evil to persecute. But we agree there's a difference between persecuting and exterminating. And what happened is that many Jews wanted to flee from Germany. They wanted to immigrate. And I think that the intention, the original intention of the Nazi regime was that the Jews would go out of Germany. So what did the Allies did during that time? They just blockade all immigration. So there were ships full of Jewish people who wanted to immigrate into the North America, and the U.S. government just sent them back into Germany. I think there were Jewish that wanted to go to Israel, and I think the Royal Navy opened fire on the ships. So I think they have a responsibility into that, because they could have prevented the Holocaust by just opening their borders.
You know, the other thing too, and this takes us back to, you know, my clarification on the term allies, which involves all these powers and all the states within those powers. And states are made up of several smaller components. And one of those is corporations who seek to use the power of the state to make profit. And let's not confuse that with, you know, the free market or even legitimate business, as far as I'm concerned. One of those corporations, when we talk about that general phrase, the Allies bear some responsibility for what happened during the Holocaust, was certainly IBM. There's a book by Edwin Black. I don't know if you're familiar with this, called IBM and the Holocaust. And it actually ties in a little bit with what's going on today with the NSA. There was a chance for Jews and gypsies and other dissidents and other people that the Nazis wanted to, at the very least in the beginning, round up and keep track of. There was a chance of them operating under the radar, so to speak, or being able to get away when the Hollerith machines were brought in, and they were able to really systematize, you know, this process of who they were looking for and what they wanted to do with them. And this is going on, obviously, with now starting from a really sort of mythological aspiration of cleansing Germany from the, you know, the evil Jews to a real precision process. And that's a corporation that bears some responsibility in that.
Absolutely. But you talk about the difference between a corporation and a free market. Mm. There were free people in the U.S. that associated themselves trying to help the Jews. There were associations, some of religious, some of non-religious, that wanted to help the Jews. But the government was against them. And at that time, the U.S. population, but the world population was less than today. So I would say there were more room to live. So it's not like in North America, there was room to welcome the Jew. Mm-hmm. There would have been room. You know, I think Canada, a billion of squared kilometer that are not used, that, okay, it may be a little bit cold, but if you have the choice between a gas chamber of Auschwitz or, I don't know, a place in some rural land in, I don't know, in Ontario or in Montana or somewhere in the U.S. or even in the British colony, yes, there were room there to welcome those people. No, the U.S. and the British government really used the violence of the state to send them back into that hellish place that was Nazi Germany. And I think the state was kind of initiating the use of force on that, because, you know, if there's a land that is not used in North America, and we know there is plenty, there are national parks that are thousands of squared kilometers. If the state wants to use its gun to prevent a Jewish refugees from going there, I think it's an aggression. Do you agree?
See, here's the question that I have about this. The most famous story that we know, I believe, is the SS St. Louis.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's this boat that was turned away. There's a book called Voyage of the Damned. And this is, I think it's like right as the war is breaking out. So 1939, 1940. And there's this question that I have about how much the people who were actually making the decisions about what to do with these refugees knew about what the conditions were in Germany. Because when we bring in this other timeline from the mythological history of World War II, that the United States had to intervene because of what the Germans were doing to the Jews. Well, the United States intervened in the war in 1941, and the extent of what was happening to Jews in Germany was certainly not known at that time. So obviously you can't apologize for this event, and you understand that these people were the victims of a great deal of persecution. But I just have that question. What was the extent of knowledge that, you know, U.S. officials and decision makers had at that point about what was going on in Germany, 1939?
Yeah. If the, you know, the U.S. and the British service secret, you know, they were able to crack the code for the German submarine, they were able to, you know, they were able to know that Nazi Germany had some, you know, some scientific plan where they were maybe trying to get an atomic bomb. So they were able to go destroy those places. I mean, if they were able to know some very secret things like that, I mean, once the Holocaust was started, I have difficulty believing that they didn't know. I may be wrong. No, I may be wrong on many things I'm saying there. So I may inviting people to do their own research, but I have difficulty believing they didn't know. You know, there were Jewish refugees that made it to the U.S. and they explained what happened in Nazi Germany before the war. Before 1939, there were still, I think, journalists, U.S. journalists or British journalists that were in Nazi Germany that could claim what happened. So,
yeah, and we have Kristallnacht.
Yeah.
This mass attack throughout Germany on Jewish businesses. That was, I believe, in 1938. So obviously there is some knowledge. I think if you go from 1945, see, in the mythical story, it seems like the United States had to enter the war in 1941 because the knowledge that they had in 1945 after the European theater of the war ended was somehow, you know, through this wormhole available to them in 1941, which it wasn't. So one of the justifications for the war isn't true. But there is a history throughout the 30s, and I'm just using this one event, Kristallnacht or the Night of Broken Glass, one of the most famous events prior to the beginning of World War II, where Jewish businesses were destroyed, some people were rounded up. Almost 100 people were killed. Thousands of people were taken and put in camps at that point. So obviously there's a justification for trying to escape, and some extent of what was going on in Germany was known. Then it just becomes a question of the decision making in the U.S. and other places they were turned away from with the St. Louis voyage, Canada being one of those places. Obviously, at the top, the higher you go, the more is known. At what level was that decision made? These are all just questions that I think are interesting jumping off points for research, but I don't necessarily have complete answers to right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the one that I found the most interesting. The Allies made this a world war that would last longer and kill more people by declaring war on Germany.
Yeah. So let's look at the fact, what happened. So in September 1939, Germany invaded Poland. And then France and Great Britain declared war on Germany for that. Nazi Germany invaded Poland, which is bad. Mm-hmm. France and Great Britain, who had already invaded, I don't know, maybe one quarter of the population of the world into colonialism.
Yeah.
So they declared war on Germany because it was evil for Germany to invade Poland. While themselves, they probably invaded 100 times more people. So they think that they have the moral authority to declare war on Germany.
I think it has a lot to do with the ideas that were being disseminated through culture from the top and from academics. So in England, you said they've colonized like this huge percentage of the world at this point, and they probably think it was a good thing. You know, this takes us back to the Rhodes Roundtable. When Rhodes is at Oxford University in the late 1800s, he has a professor named John Ruskin who basically tells Rhodes and the other students, hey, you know, we're Great Britain. We're the best. We owe it to the world. We owe it to the world to, you know, spread British culture however possible. The Nazis didn't have a terribly different story that they were telling their people.
The hypocrisy doesn't end there. Is that at the same time that Nazi Germany invaded Poland, the Soviet Union also invaded Poland. And I think even the Soviet Union occupied a slightly larger area of Poland. But did the Soviet Union receive a declaration of war from France and Great Britain? No! They were going to receive help and an alliance with it. It's a total hypocrisy. Mm. We have to put ourselves, I would say, into the statist logic. At that time, there existed, a principle after the First World War called the right of the people to self-govern. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think it's a statist principle, because the concept of people, it's still a collectivist idea. As a libertarian, we more believe in first the individual and then a voluntary association. So the concept of nationality and people, it's still statist. But there's an amount of voluntarism into the fact that, you know, that people that are of the same origin, the same culture, the same language, to live together. Mm-hmm. So the right of the people to self-govern was proclaimed by the victors of the First World War. But that principle was only good to the victors of the First World War.
Yeah.
And so not the German people, and obviously not all the hundreds of million people living into the colony. We have to understand that Hitler was asking to Poland to give back a part of Poland that was German. I don't think it's a good thing to do that, but in the statist logic, I think that Hitler had more right to claim that land from Poland than, I would say, you know, the Allies to start the war, or even Poland to occupy that a land where German people had lived under a German state for, you know, for hundreds of years. And Great Britain gave a war guarantee to Poland. So what it meant is that Great Britain said to Poland, we will bring all the British Empire to war to protect yourself if you don't want to give back to Germany the German people that wants to live back into Germany. So I think it's totally stupid and evil doing that. So it's the Allies, I think, that spread the war. Probably, I think it would have been a war. In fact, if the British would not have given the war guarantee to Poland, and I take those ideas from Patrick Buchanan called Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. It's a great book that I recommend to read. And he said that probably the British would not have given the war guarantee to Poland. Probably Poland would have given back the city of Danzig to Germany. And probably that Germany would have allied itself with Poland because, you know, at that time, Poland was not a democratic state. It was a kind of a military dictator where there was anti-Semitism from that dictator. So probably because if you ask the Poles at that time, I think the Poles were a lot more closer to the German than there were from the Russian. So that made, by giving that war guarantee to Poland, it made that Hitler and Stalin made a temporary alliance and that they invaded Poland together. So.
And we started this particular subject with the idea of what, just to give you a vocabulary word for statist logic, they called this national self-determination. Yeah. So it's interesting that people playing around with that concept, which could just be pure propaganda and window dressing, which is what I believe it is, but that they would also think, I shouldn't say they should think, because I think they're aware, obviously, of their own bullshit and what they're feeding to people, but that people in these countries would accept both the idea of self-determination and a war guarantee. We will go to war if these other events that the people in this country can't control, we will put them into a war. As the political decision makers, it's really bizarre.
Yeah. So I think that the objective of Nazi Germany, if you compare those objectives with the rest of the other imperial state, I think there's no big difference. I would even dare saying that Nazi Germany was probably more modest in its ambition than Great Britain and France.
I would say this. I would say that they were more, as far as actual imperial designs are concerned, they were more modest than, say, Great Britain at the time. if you look at the sort of mythological undercurrent that's at play in Nazi Germany, that they're descendants of Aryan supermen from the lost continent of Atlantis, and they're going to go find biblical treasures to give them magical power, there's not a lot of modesty there. But to your point that compared to the other, or certain allied powers, their imperial designs are far more modest.
Yeah, exactly. So what I think that the Hitler's ambition was to first to overturn the Versailles Treaty.
Mm-hmm.
Then he wanted to unite the German. You know, that's why he annexed a part of Czechoslovakia because it was German people. In Austria, there were German. It was kind of German people. And then he had some imperial ambition into the Eastern territories. He really claimed it, I think, in Mein Kampf, saying that Russia will be for us what India was for Great Britain.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. Into the mythology of Nazi Germany, yeah, that they thought that they were the best. But if we look at that, the U.S. still, this kind of mythology exists at a certain level, and I think in every country we are the best, we are the blah blah blah. The Great Britain had that idea that, as you said, that it could colonize the world. The U.S. thought that they had that great destiny, that when they exterminated the Indian in North America to colonize the U.S. continent. Even Hitler, I think he made a reference to what the U.S. did to the Indian, mm-hmm. saying that it's a superior race.
And it's interesting, just a point on that too, one final comparison between these various powers at the time. I don't think Great Britain ever went anywhere where their boats came ashore and the people who were native to that land said, oh, thank God you're here. The United States, there might be a couple of exceptions to that rule. There might have been a contingent in Iraq that was happy to see Saddam go. Obviously, if they had known what the condition of Iraq would be 2 or 3 years into the future, they probably wouldn't have, waved their little flags and accepted the candy that the parade of soldiers threw at them. But Hitler, the story is told like first he marched east to Poland and then to Austria. Well, in Austria, and this is obviously no apology for anything Hitler did, but because of the contextual history of that region that obviously most people studying the war don't understand, he was greeted in Austria as, I don't want to say a savior, but to some degree, a liberator.
Yeah, but I think most people in Austria agreed with to unite with Germany. Not all. Most people who disagree was the Austrian state, because I think it's
yeah.
If Hitler unite Germany and Austria, all the Austrian politicians, they just lose their power and their advantage of being head of state. But you said something interesting. I think that there will always be people that will profit from a change of power. I'm sure that when the British, came to India, there were probably already some fight in India between, different group of people. Mm-hmm. And maybe some people profited from the fact that the British came. The same way, I think, I'm pretty sure that when the U.S., liberated France from the German occupation, most French people were probably happy. But when Hitler invaded the Ukraine, I think many Ukrainian people were happy that the German came because they really hated Stalin.
Yeah.
So we can always find people, a group of people that will be happy of an invasion, no doubt. But we can never ask all the dead people, were you happy once you're dead that your country was invaded by a lesser evil than the other before? No, we cannot ask that.
And I think it's just worth, before we move on to the conclusion here, it's also just worth pointing out that obviously within all states, within all societies, divisions exist. And one trick, certainly very prevalent in the 20th century, of invaders Or, you know, maybe if they're not even explicitly marching an army into a territory, one trick of invaders has always been to exploit the divisions that already exist in that society. So, you know, we have throughout the, you know, the post-World War II period, the United States is running something called Operation Gladio, where, you know, they say, OK, well, this small division exists in this country. So what we'll need is some of their, you know, military uniforms and some machine guns and some agents who will wear them and hold those machine guns and some planes to drop some leaflets on the people who are stunned by what happens. So that is a trick of imperialists to exploit existing conflicts. I think that probably goes at least back to Spain in the 15th century.
Yeah, they exploited division among the Indian and the slave. They brought slave into South America. They put slave of different culture together so that they could fight together to be sure that they don't revolt. The same way that the British exploited the division between the Hindu and the Muslim in what was India and Pakistan were together. Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Hmm. I just want to finish a point that I think is very important.
Sure.
About the ambitions of Hitler. So the idea that Hitler wanted to rule the world, I think it's one of the big fear in the myth of World War II. As I say, Hitler was evil. Maybe he dreamt of ruling the world. I think many people maybe dream. When you're a psychopath, I think it's obviously a dream you can have. But I think that if there is reasonable proof that Hitler didn't want war with the Western power. Rapidly, Hitler built a West Wall with France. He's still a lot of energy and manpower building a West Wall. I don't think it's very coherent with wanting to rule the world. Hitler made, I think there's archive proof of orders to his general that said, we have to try to avoid war with Great Britain. Once the war was made, because as I say, it's France and Great Britain that declared war on him. Once he had to wage war because war was going on. There's an interesting event at the Dunkirk event when, you know, when all the French and British soldiers were surrounded at Dunkirk and they fled into boat to England. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Hitler really ordered his general to stop the attack. And his general were astonished. And many military historians blame Hitler that it was a big strategic mistake. But what is, I think, is that Hitler ordered that to stop the offensive because he wanted to make peace with Great Britain. I think he thought... If he would have continued the offensive, probably he would have killed or captured a few hundred thousands of British soldiers. And from a military standpoint, if Hitler had wanted to really rule Europe and the world, that would have been a good thing to do from a military standpoint. But he didn't do it. And I think it's because he wanted to make peace with Great Britain. Also, It's Great Britain who first bombed German city and not the opposite. Hitler at beginning said that we have to avoid to retaliate because he didn't want war with Great Britain.
And let's remember too that he had a great deal of admiration for Great Britain.
In Mein Kampf, Hitler says that the idea of the Kaiser to build a fleet and to have colony in Africa was very bad idea because it bring Germany in conflict with Great Britain. So for me, I think he didn't want war with them. So now people could tell me, yes, Hitler also invaded Denmark, Norway, Belgium, and Holland. But what I think is once Great Britain and France declared war on Germany, from a military point, there's an incentive to Germany to invade those countries before they will be occupied by the enemy. For example, when the war started, I think Great Britain tried to invade Norway to cut the iron supply that was going to Germany from Sweden. So That's the reason why Germany invaded Norway. And I don't want to defend Germany, but I think if the Great Britain and France would not have declared war on Germany, I think that probably Germany would not have invaded all those countries. I may be wrong, but I think that the fact that they declared war on Germany gives Germany a great incentive to invade those countries. All that on a military strategic point. So
that speaks to a point put in a simple way. Hitler didn't come to power and didn't rise in power by saying to the people of Germany, wait till you see the messed up stuff that I do once you give me unlimited power. And this is what I dealt with in the American Way series, that people have to be on board with this. Even if you have conscription, you know, you can't raise a loyal army who parades through German cities in these massively extravagant celebrations of Nazi power if you do not have a very effective propaganda system in place. Now, obviously, the Nazis had that, but this wasn't North Korea. You know, this was a very civilized, very cultured modern state in the 1930s. Very, very similar to Great Britain in the U.S. as far as economic power and culture. I mean, obviously, or economic power potential, I should say, because Germany certainly had its difficulties after World War One, largely imposed by the Treaty of Versailles. But this was not some, third world hellhole. This was a modern civilized state, many of aspects of which would look very, very similar to the U.S. today. So not all of their propaganda was invented. And I think that you make a very good point that Hitler was able to sell their actions as not offensive actions, even though there was an offensive component to it about expanding Lebensraum or living space, but also as a defensive component too. We're being closed in on by these great imperial powers of Western Europe, and this will be the end of Germany if we don't act.
Yeah.
So at this point, do you want to wrap up with the conclusion here?
Yeah, the consequence of that intervention is, we said, Great Britain and France said, we have to go to war to defend Poland sovereignty. Considering all the hypocrisy that the Allies were already violating the sovereignty of hundreds of million people into their colony, they still claimed they wanted to go to war to defend Poland. So look what happened to Poland after the Second World War. And not only Poland, all Eastern Europe. What happened to them?
Yeah, after the end of the war, they were sucked into a worse situation.
Yeah, they were sold, and the Soviet Union negotiated to occupy those land with the Allies and all the conference they made. So the result is that we brought down a totalitarian regime called Nazi Germany, but now we have a totalitarian regime called the Soviet Union that is now a superpower occupying half of Europe that will now have the nuclear weapon, and communism will spread into the colony because, you know, most people of the colony wanted to be free, but because their aspiration of freedom were not met by the Allies that were their master, so many of them turned to communism. So communism spread all over the world. And we know the result of that in China and in everywhere, the millions of people that were killed, tortured, starved to death. I think World War II is greatly responsible for that because during the war, the U.S., they helped the Soviet Union, they helped the Chinese, they helped Ho Chi Minh into Indochina to fight their enemy there. So No wonder communism come out after that, which is a terrible result. But not only that, I think World War II legitimized statism as a solution to every problem. It's like, look, the power, by giving power to the state, we vanquished the great evil that was Nazi Germany. So now the state is viewed as a solution to to everything. So after that, there's the rise of the welfare state everywhere. And we know what the welfare state is leading us today to a total economic collapse. And this goes well in pair with the warfare state. World War II created the military-industrial complex in the United States. It created the Cold War. It created an incentive for that military complex to always have war. So now you have the Cold War. And I think that the Cold War, Marie Rothbard made an excellent article on that, saying that the Cold War is the fault mostly of U.S. imperialism rather than the Soviet expansionism. He explained very well that the Soviet Union, the leader of the Soviet Union, what they want is to exploit their people quietly, because for them, expanding would jeopardize their position. Of course, communism is expansionist, but it's more into the ideology that capitalism will create the condition for communism to arise. Marie Rothbard really showed that the Soviet Union was a lot less expansionist than the US. But of course, as I said, communism spread everywhere because people were pissed off and were attracted by ideology. And of course, I think the Soviet Union maybe helped people there, no doubt. But yeah, so this war, it created the Cold War. And as you said at the beginning, it created the idea that we need to do a preemptive war to prevent evil like Hitler from happening. So the libertarian idea of non-intervention will be discredited, because non-intervention means you let Hitler happen, which I think we show that is not true. It's Hitler happened because of state intervention.
This was and just to interject there, this rhetoric was very, very heavy in the 2008 presidential election when Ron Paul was presenting this idea, and it was immediately rebranded as isolationism, as it was at the time. Any critic of the war was an isolationist. And I just ask people who said this, just try to apply this logic that we use for discussions of the state to personal life or community life, where we don't talk to Iran, we're not talking to these people, we're not isolationists. Like, in other words, looking for an avenue around military intervention is isolationist. And if you did this on a community level, if you had a problem with your neighbor, instead of talking to them, you lob grenades into their yard. And this gets you branded as a community team player. Instead of just trying to talk to them or accept a disagreement, that makes you an isolationist, right? Solving problems nonviolently is isolationism. Aggressive force that costs innocent people their lives is participating in a community, or in what we're actually talking about here, the global solution.
I agree, totally agree, yes. So what could have been rapidly an alternative solution of non-intervention? But I think that first, just opening the borders to all people who wanted to flee Nazi dictatorship would have helped a lot. You know, non-intervention would mean you don't help those people first. I also think that, but look at Switzerland. Switzerland doesn't have any army. Switzerland is stuck between France, Italy, and Germany. How much time were they attacked or invaded in the 20th century? Zero. They were never invaded. They don't even have an army. But Switzerland doesn't make imperial alliance that would force their people to go die for the imperialism of their neighbor. No, but in Switzerland, I think we know that it's a place where people have, every citizen have a gun.
Yeah.
I think there's a quote from the Japanese Admiral Yamamoto saying that the idea to invade the U.S. would be a total disaster because in the U.S., every citizen has a gun. So Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union, one of the first things they did when they came to power is to put some very strict gun control law. So no wonder when you invade a country where people don't have guns to defend themselves, it's really easy to conquer the people. And I would invite people one solution to read the Practical Anarchy from Stefan Molyneux, where he shows that less state there is, less incentive there is for a dictator to invade. Because when you invade, and for example, you invade a very big state, once you're there, you can take over all the statist tools to enslave the people that are there. While why, if they are already in a state of, I would say, mostly anarchy or freedom, it's a lot more hard, especially if everybody has a gun. As a solution, you open your border, you don't help the dictator. And I think that freedom has been proven to create a lot more wealth than state intervention.
Absolutely. Now, that's wealth for people. You know, running through most of what we've talked about for the last hour and a half, there certainly are rewards for certain people using the power of the state, but that's not the kind of wealth that we're talking about here. So I certainly understand that point.
If I can just suggest your reader, your listener that would be interested in some readings about that subject,
mm-hmm.
It's on those books that I based many of my arguments. First of all, there's a book called Human Smoke by Nicholson Baker. This book was recommended by Lou Rockwell. Nicholson Baker looks like a left-wing pacifist. His book is about quote on Winston Churchill and events that led to the war. It's a very interesting book. Another book would be from Patrick James Buchanan. It's Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. Patrick Buchanan is more of a right-wing conservative, but he's in the school of thought, what we call the old right, so he's against war. It's a very interesting book that I really suggest. If you're interested into that matters, it's a must read. It was also recommended by Lou Rockwell. There's Anthony Sutton, who wrote many books called Wall Street, like Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, and Wall Street and FDR. The thesis of Anthony Sutton is that there are people in the United States that he calls himself socialists because it's very wealthy people that want to use the state at their advantage, and they prefer to have some regime in other country with whom they're going to enrich themselves. So Anthony Sutton really showed how Wall Street helped Hitler and the Bolshevik.
There's just on Sutton's work, because Sutton was an academic who was writing books on, you know, really specific technical subjects like military hardware in some of these places. And then I think through his research, he got to a point where he was like, wait a minute. And that was the genesis, this realization of like, okay, wow, look at this car plant, you know, in Russia. That was the genesis of these Wall Street and books that he wrote, I want to say in the 1970s, but I could be off on that. Just a simpler version and more, we've described it on my show, or some of the guests I've had on talking about similar subjects have described it more of as a cartoonish version. Is Gary Allen's None Dare Call It a Conspiracy. None Dare Call It a Conspiracy. And, you know, he says that these people who call themselves capitalists love socialism because it centralizes the control and allows them easier access.
Yeah, but Anthony Sutton, there's another book he wrote. I see it on my shelf. It's National Suicide. It's the military help to the Soviet Union. Because if you agree with the Austrian economic thesis, communism doesn't create any technical innovations. The only reason I think why the Soviet Union was able to last, first, to be able to resist Nazi aggression and to last almost 70 years, it's because of all the help they got from the West. Mm-hmm. So, as I said, mm-hmm. when we say that our state are there to protect us, that's totally ridiculous. As we show, they helped Hitler, they helped the Soviet Union. So, yeah, Anthony Sutton wrote great books, and he said that the Soviet Union could never have lasted all that time or resist without the help of, Ford going build car plant into Yeah, there. So another book that I would recommend is Practical Anarchy from Stefan Molyneux. He really explained how a stateless society will defend itself a lot better against a so-called state aggression. I could also recommend, of course, your podcast, Brett, because you did excellent podcasts on all those subjects before. There's good article on Lou Rockwell, especially from Murray Rothbard. And finally, I have another book from, it's a Canadian historian called Jacques Powells. He's more of a leftist and a socialist, but he wrote two great books, one called The Myth of the Good War and Big Business with Hitler, when he showed all the help that Nazi Germany got from Western corporations, a little bit like Sutton, but from a mostly left-wing version. So,
and just a couple of the books that I mentioned, IBM and the Holocaust is written by Edwin Black. There's another book that I've been holding but didn't get to, but that's okay. It's called Hitler's Banker, written by John Weitz, and it is about Halmar Schacht, who was one of the central figures initially in building the Nazi economy, later became a critic of the policies in Nazi Germany and managed to survive his criticism. In other words, he wasn't killed. He was imprisoned, ultimately.
Omar Shark, that you just mentioned, this name is brought up plenty of time in the book of Anthony Sutton or Jacques Powells that I just mentioned. Yes. Oh, yeah, you're right.
And the final one, which I've covered on the show before, Wall Street, Banks, and American Foreign Policy, written by Murray Rothbard, I believe, in the early 80s, is also worth checking out. You can hear me read an audiobook of it in episode 231 of School Sucks Podcast.
Great.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time and sharing all this information with us. I find these kinds of discussions incredibly valuable. So please, Manuel, reach out again. And thanks for, first of all, being a listener.
Yeah, but thank you very much, Brett, for inviting me. It's the first time of my life I'm doing a podcast, so I may apologize for your listener if I was not always clear in my way to speaking, maybe a little bit nervous. Maybe sometime I was looking for a word in English, but I really appreciated it. I dream to do that with you since many years ago, so I'm pretty happy for what we've done. And I hope if some of your listeners would like to come in contact with me, I'm in your Facebook friends, so they can reach me through that way if they're interested in having a chat with me.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks again so much. And I mean it. We'll have to do it again in the future.
Thank you, Brett. Bye-bye.